Blog Talk Radio.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright, sunshiny day. Gonna be bright, sunshiny day. I think I can make it now, the pain is gone. All of the bad feelings have disappeared. Here is that rainbow I've been praying for. It's gonna be bright.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Bonnie Kay. I'd like to welcome you to our Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexities of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you would like to make during this broadcast, you can either call them in at area code 646-716-4893, or if you're radio shy, you can feel free to email me at bonkaye@aol.com. Before I introduce my very special guest for tonight, I just want to make a brief announcement that as the weeks are rolling along, we're getting ready for our California Healing Weekend in September. It's going to be a very dynamic weekend with women coming in from all over the country and some from out of the country to unite together, to heal together, to learn from each other, to tell each other stories, to understand exactly what you mean before you even say it in a room full of nurturing and supportive women where you will bond and make new friends and relationships that will last you on your journey towards healing. So there's still time to get in on the healing weekend. It is in Los Angeles. It's about 5 minutes away from the Los Angeles airport, so it's very convenient. There's a shuttle bus that'll take you right to the hotel. We have a group rate, so if you are interested in joining me there, please write to me at bonkaye@aol.com, and I'll be very happy to send you the information. Tonight I have a very special guest with me. I'm very proud to have Dr. Karen Huffer. And Dr. Huffer is a world-renowned expert in the legal abuse system. She has out a number of books, but the latest one is Legal Abuse Syndrome, 8 Steps for Avoiding the Traumatic Stress Caused by the Justice System. And I think that of the several thousand women each month who listen to this broadcast, you certainly know those words, traumatic stress justice system. So that's why having you here tonight, Karen, is just a wonderful thing. So I'd like to introduce you, and thank you so much for coming.
Oh, I'm happy to be with you again.
Yes, and I want to tell you that a lot of our women really do suffer with the whole justice system, and it really does create a whole post-traumatic stress disorder within itself, being part of a justice system where you have to go and stand up and fight for your rights that you're never really going to get. So how did you begin embarking in this battle?
Well, I had a private practice, I still do, in marriage and family therapy for about 30 years. And late 80s, early 90s, I began to see that the people in my practice who were involved in litigation did not get better and stay better the way that the others did. And I believed, I was observing, that being involved in the court system can be a variable in terms of your emotional health. Well, I began to study that, and as I did peer review research, I realized that I was getting an awful lot of agreement from my peers. I'm saying, are you seeing this in your practices too? And they're saying yes, overwhelmingly. So I set about to study that and studied. My first book came out in 95, where I identified legal abuse syndrome as it's a type, a subtype of post-traumatic stress disorder. Actually, if you are diagnosing it formally, it comes in under the causative. Why do you have PTSD? You didn't go to war. Well, the reason you have it is because you got caught up in litigation where you felt helpless and in terrible jeopardy at the same time. And all of that come together, it is too expensive. My clients, many have been very successful career people, and they are then, after being involved in litigation for a while, they become part of what I'm calling the nouveau pauvre in America, the new poor. They are not poor for any reason of their own, except they got drawn into litigation and trying to just stay afloat and survive in litigation took everything. And very often they've been targeted for mean takings. In other words, if we can get that house away from them, she'll leave him. If we can put this financial pressure on them, we'll paper them to death. We'll just force them to spend a lot of money. These are legal games that should not even be allowed. Our system is not a toy to be played with. It's a serious service in a civilized country for people to go where they can resolve conflict. What I find is my people go there for a right and a reasonable solution, and they come away injured. They come away with a PTSD. Then the other side starts saying, well, they're crazy. And we'll see how they're crazy. No, they're injured. It's a psychiatric injury. They're normal in an abnormal setting that is causing such an extreme trauma that they are injured. The same as if every time you went to court, the judge got off the bench and hit you in the knee with a hammer. You are injured. And it's that same kind of thing. So I have professional people that are afraid to use their protections in court because they don't want to admit that they have an injury because they're afraid they'll be called crazy. You're going to be called crazy anyway.
Uh-huh.
If you don't agree with an opponent who is either a coercive controller or for some reason, they're in a legal war with them, normally they call you crazy anyhow. So are you going to be crazy with protection, which is really the Americans with Disabilities Act? Because it says if you have an injury, you are entitled in court then to accommodation. And those accommodations make all the difference. We halt the court with the regular run of abusive behaviors and turn it toward them having to be more patient, slow things down. You'd be surprised when you go to court, if you just slow it all down, how much it can help our clients. But they come in good faith, and it's like they get swept off in this current and just drown after a while.
I think that the fact that divorce has become such a big business today, as, you know, confirmed by the new movie that's, you know, come out about Divorce Court, and the high cost of divorce that can ruin people, that by the time you're done, there's very little left because you've given it all to the courts. And I think that it's hard enough ending a marriage, but having to lose everything you have because you're ending it is really unconscionable to me. And yet I do feel women are really at a disadvantage. Now, some people disagree with me, but from the women that I've worked with for 30 years, which is tens of thousands of them, they don't seem to be coming out ahead in most cases. I'm not saying in a couple of cases they, you know, don't come out ahead, but I would say 90% of all the women I work with do not come out ahead of the game, and they end up losing so much. Do you find that to be the case?
Yes. There was a time when the women, they said, got everything, and perhaps that's true. Perhaps there was a period where it all went to the women. They got the kids, they got taken care of, et cetera. I don't find that anymore. And some of the meanest behavior I have ever seen has to do with some of the guardians ad litem, the court appointees who are put on these cases to try and help sort out and protect the children. And they wind up, it is the strangest thing. They're supposed to be neutral. But I find them hating these women sometimes. You know, I've been in court as an expert and as an advocate with these women, and I am stunned at the, there isn't even a pretense of being fair. They come in with teeth bared, and these are technically officers of the court. You know, I've had minors counsel come in and lie to the court. I had one tell the court that my client was diagnosed with depression and refused to take her medication.
Uh-huh.
She had been diagnosed with depression, and she never had been prescribed medication. And I wrote a letter to the judge, and I told him I was shocked at the misinformation that was put on the record, and here is what, you know, these are the facts. I do what I can to straighten those things out for people, because what happens when you go in, if you're up against a very manipulative opponent, anyone with sociopathic traits or borderline traits or narcissistic, that kind of thing, they come into court and they create your impression to the court by calling you names, reporting misinformation that you so-called did that you didn't do, trying to set kids up to say things that, you know, are not true. And if you can slow that down, get the accommodations, and have advocacy in there, and be sure that you understand when you get accommodations, they're administrative. You don't walk into the court, and I have my clients do this all the time. They walk into the court with a letter from their doctor that says, please, I need this. You don't put that before the court. You don't put that into the record in the discretionary area. The judge is not supposed to even know about that. The judge can only know technically what your accommodations are. My clients very often, they do just fine as long as they get breaks if they need them. They can record things so that they have a private record of what went on. Many times they are so stressed, they don't hear in that courtroom. They don't remember. And so it's important that we have accommodations that fit them. Some of my clients cannot go in the same courtroom with their opponent. It's downright dangerous. And so
I don't know if you've seen this with, you know, many of your cases. I know that our cases are somewhat unique in the sense that it's not just a divorce because two people can't get along together. It's a divorce because a husband's leading another life that, you know, he doesn't want to stay in a marriage anymore for the most part. But a lot of times throughout those years, because, you know, maybe he married him with good intentions. Maybe he was hoping against hope that he wouldn't be who he is. But in time, that just doesn't work. And, you know, he is a gay man, and he's going into a straight marriage. And it's just not a good natural match because he doesn't belong there. So over time, you know, it usually ends up that he becomes emotionally abusive with the family because he feels very trapped. He doesn't want to be there, and he can't be honest about what he is because he's protecting himself until the end when finally he meets somebody, and that's usually when men come to me when they're ready to go because they met someone. But in the meantime, you know, they spend 20, 30 years trying to figure out who they are, but they expect their wives within the next week to just learn it, accept it, and move on because they're ready to run. But the women always have been aware of the fact there's something wrong in the marriage. They can't put their finger on it because he's not being honest about it. So a lot of them have, like, a lot of emotional turmoil for years. And, of course, you know, being sexually rejected, being told you're at fault for things when it has nothing to do with you because they don't want to take the responsibility. So a lot of times they're going into court being very vulnerable to start with because it's been a slow emotional peel over years of losing your self-confidence, losing your self-esteem in who you are. And sometimes some of these men are just very nasty and controlling. They weren't that involved with the children and the family to start with. Now they want control. They want to keep their control. You know, they want to have the kids or they want to split the kids, even though the kids never really spend any time with them. And then when they get the kids, they're really not spending time with them anyway. So I see so much of this in our particular community going on. Do you see that in the work that you do at all?
Yes, I certainly do. Some of the saddest cases have been transgender men that then are through surgery and attempting to become female and children and how their children are having to try and cope with this. These are tragic cases. The other thing, this is where so many of the accusations of parental alienation come in, and the accusations that are false and that follow. There is definitely something that a parent can attempt to turn a child against another. I'm aware that that can happen. Mm-hmm. However, the entire issue of parental alienation that was set out into the courts before any real research was done or anything has done a great deal of damage, because what happens is nobody can tell that somebody is alienating or not. You know, it's very hard to tell. Nobody can tell what's really going on in these relationships. And yet they will very often take the child away from the mother. They will punish the mother and claim that that mother is alienating the children.
Mm-hmm. And that to me is just so ridiculous, right? It's so hurtful to the mothers because, you know, I'm dealing with some of the aftermath of that, and I see their hearts broken. They were the best mothers they could be, and all of a sudden they don't even have their children. Because somebody
right.
wants to control the situation. And it's not out of love, it's out of control.
Yes, yes. Because when you love the child and put the child first, then we demonstrate to them how adults solve problems. And we do that in a peaceful way and in a responsible way. But the courts are not behaving in a responsible way in many cases because what they are doing is creating more stress between the two parties. then they call it high conflict. It isn't high conflict in many cases that I have. Two people are not just intransigent and refusing to get along with one another. One of them has been victimized by accident or design. They're trying to just get a reasonable solution to the problem and end the pain. The other side is angry and cannot figure out why they can't control and have their way in a situation that to the other party seems outrageous and abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And we never know what the internal dynamics are, but usually it comes down to coercive control, narcissistic behavior, these things where gay people, there isn't just one pattern for a gay person.
Mm-hmm.
Very often there's a great deal of confusion. But what a betrayal, like you were saying, to find that you're not attractive to your spouse. What happened? Well, if the spouse goes for another woman, now you're a woman, and you can say, what does she have I don't have? When they go for a guy, what do you do with that?
Well, the difficult part is that there's really nothing you can do about it, but that's the difference, I think, between a marriage where there's just infidelity, which, you know, okay, things happen, life, you know, people are people. But this is where you're living with somebody who's living a lie every single day of his life, and he's able to compartmentalize this. About 20% of our women get STDs, ranging from HIV to syphilis, you know, not even having any idea that this is going on, you know, and their husbands do manage to somehow have sex with them just to keep up the pretense. But it's just such a heartbreaking thing, and believe me, I work with a lot of the gay men, and my heart goes out to them too, because they're living a life that's not theirs to live. They made a mistake, and they just don't know how to correct it. And I tell them that you did not have a choice in being gay, but you have a choice in being honest. And you owe it to your wife to tell her why this marriage isn't working. I always say it's the example of if I have a 500-piece jigsaw puzzle and I'm missing one piece and it's never going to fit together and I never know why, and how would I know the piece was missing? So you don't have the right to withhold that piece of missing information when your wife is trying her hardest and nothing's working and she's internalizing she's to blame and you're not helping it by saying, no, honey, it's not you, it's me. So there's a lot of issues that come into that. One of the questions somebody just asked me, her name is Tina from South Dakota. She just wrote in. She said, if I could ask you this question, could you please ask Dr. Huffer, what is the difference between mediation and divorce?
Well, divorce is simply the disengagement of the marriage. It's the paperwork and the legal disengagement, basically. Mediation, they usually send people to mediation to try and not get into protracted litigation where you're fighting everything in court, but you go and try and settle things with a mediator. Normally, the mediator puts each person in a different room, and then the mediator back and forth and talks with them. Sometimes they will put them together, and then they try and work out the issues. You can learn a lot about someone in mediation because if they're a coercive controller or the sociopathic kind of person, they tend to refuse to negotiate and they refuse to mediate. So they just kind of fold their arms and say, well, we'll just see if, you know, what happens in court or something. They cannot, incompetent at cooperating. Many of us are with someone and you can't figure it out because it just doesn't make sense. You're not behaving in any kind of way that benefits you or me or the kids or the situation. You are behaving unreasonably. Well, that is very often simply because they're incompetent at cooperating. When you have a oriented person, they got to have the power, and they're righteous even when they're wrong. And being right is more important than anything else, and they believe they're right even when they're wrong and abusive. So
someone, you know, like that, it doesn't pay to mediate with because they're not willing to bend at all.
Exactly. So a group, a domestic violence group out of Pennsylvania, designed a pre-screening for mediation. I have that. If someone wants to email me at legalabuse@gmail.com, I will be glad to provide that to you. It's a pre-screening, and instead of spending all the money on mediation, if you do this screening and there's ever been domestic violence or coercive control in the relationship, then you can tell the court, we simply don't fit the profile to go to mediation. I had one woman, they were ready to send them a fifth time to mediation, and the guy was never going to cooperate. It simply wasn't going to happen. So if mediation is going to work, you usually know it the first time. You begin to get closer in what you have differences on, usually the division of marital property, how custody is going to go down, et cetera. I feel bad for the kids in a lot of these relationships because the courts treat the kids like property. And
exactly.
Very sensitive. And these kids, you know, the transgender male father, the kid just lost the father in the father role and in any sense that they have ever identified. And it's extremely hard for all of them. It's very tragic.
It is, and I feel so bad because I do have several women in that situation where their husbands are now becoming women, and it's so confusing for the kids. I mean, I think gay is confusing enough, and I explain to men also that you have to give people a chance to absorb this, to learn how to accept it. You know, when they've struggled for so many years themselves, and they want this instant response coming out of their women and children. And it just doesn't happen that way. And then they feel, well, you must be telling the kids something bad about me. No, nobody's saying anything bad. It's just a matter of a different way of life that we're, many of us, you know, we're very accepting. We're not homophobic when it comes to other people. But when it enters your marriage, it's like a whole new story. And it takes time to accept this and to understand it. How did this happen to me? So but a lot of the men don't really care. You know, they just want what they want when they want it.
Right.
And they're not particularly necessarily, they weren't great fathers to start with, but now all of a sudden they want to be equal co-parents.
Well, another thing that comes into play is the financial burden. If they're going through transgender things and you're breaking up a marriage, you've got a financial burden. Now you've got to pay child support and you've got to pay maintenance sometimes. You know, so many of them say, I'll just take the kid, even though it isn't the best for the kid and it's confusing. It's cheaper, you know, to take the kid and not pay the child support. And then they accuse, it's a trick knee of the court. They accuse the other parent of parental alienation, and the court just kicks right in to begin to attack that parent. And very often the parent wasn't. They could have been confused. They could be trying to speak honestly, but they never set out to destroy the relationship with the other parent. But it is terribly sad. And I had one case where it wasn't the male that was gay, it was the woman. And he certainly had not a clue for a long time. And finally, it came out. It was very hard on him, and they had no children. So it was still extremely hard. He died very young. You know, it's interesting what these stressors put on people. He died at something like 53, and it had just been too much for him, the whole thing, just too much. But
you know, I wanted to mention in your book, you have when you start out your book and you're talking about, you know, the justice system, but you have a line in here that you were mentioning before that I would like to just repeat because this really affects so many of our women. And this is inside the book, you know, Legal Abuse Syndrome, that you can get right off of Amazon. And it says, helplessness in the face of jeopardy is a formula for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think that is so powerful, helplessness in the face of jeopardy. When you just see that danger is coming your way and you just don't know how to stop it.
exactly. And that's when your limbic system kicks in your brain and your whole physiological being changes. And you say, I always have been able to do this before. I have people say, I don't need accommodations in court. I've always been able to cope before. But your body has changed. Your brain has changed. Broca's area in the brain, which is what controls expressive speech, changes. So you'll get in court, and you'll know what you need to do and what you want to say, and you open your mouth, and it simply doesn't come out. And it's physiological. It's not that you're stupid. It's not that anything's gone wrong. And you know, my people will come out and say, how can I be so dumb? How can I have done? No. It's normal. It's very normal. And you also can become, so you look paranoid. And people will say, you're getting paranoid. No, that's called, I call it obsessive compulsive hypervigilance, which is what you do when your life is out of control. It's how your body reacts, saying, you need to get your life back under control. So you become hypervigilant, and you're looking for, how did I lose control? Well, nothing can change you more than having the person you trusted, depended on, your best friend, your mate, not be who you thought they were.
Right.
Who is this person? It's like a bad dream, you know, where they change totally in front of you. It's way beyond betrayal. It's a mixture of mourning and grieving and loss and shock and betrayal and confusion. It is the overwhelming feeling when you feel 10 conflicting things at the same time. It's a very tough place to work out of for people.
And then on top of all of that, then you have to face a court system that's not particularly sympathetic and not on your side. And I know that one of the things I had spoken to you on another show about, on my book show, was one of the things I was so much trying to pull together here, and I have some wonderful volunteers around the country, you know, who have some legal expertise or just activists or wonderful women, was to try to put something together and stop the no-fault divorce. Because in many cases, I believe there is a fault. If you enter a marriage under good intentions and you're a good wife and you do all the right things, is it your fault that your husband's sexuality wasn't what you thought it was? Or that he wants to leave you for a man and because you're a woman? I mean, why is that your fault?
Yeah, and it isn't at all. And no fault very often means no responsibility. And that's a social problem because, and I described that in my book, I have 8 steps that you go through, and one is blaming.
Right, I have that right here, in fact.
There has to be attribution, or we as a culture don't move forward. We can't just all dance around and say, well, nobody ever has, it isn't attributed to anybody. Nobody ever gets blamed for anything. We just are no fault. Wrong. We have to have attribution. And you have to say, okay, where did it go wrong? Who is responsible? And I give a breakdown in there as to the degrees of blame that we have to put on certain people. Did they choose to hurt you? And once they knew they were hurting you, did they continue to hurt you? Or was it a circumstance like you're talking about? They were gay. They didn't know it. They tried to please their parents. They did the best they could. All of a sudden, they realized their integrity just isn't there. So they try and work their way out of it. Well, that's a circumstance. They didn't intend to hurt you. But after that, now how are they coping with it? Are they taking care of you, protecting your parenthood? Are they cooperating, being fair? Or are they nasty and off with somebody else who's saying, we'll get rid of that bitch, you know? And these things are, you never know how it's going to manifest. But when any partner gets in a relationship with another person, it can definitely damage the original relationship that they're dissolving.
that, or even, you know, when I look at women who may not have a gay partner, but they're certainly in abusive marriages where there's domestic violence, why should there have to be a no fault there? There is a fault. So
I
feel that our divorce laws really need to be changed, because they're certainly on, I mean, they're certainly, this is not an issue you can bring up in court, and I feel that's very unfair. I mean, you did everything the right way. Someone betrayed you, somebody misled you, someone's out there having all kinds of sexual encounters with other people and bringing home diseases to you. Yeah, I do think there's a fault there. Why is that person not held accountable for that?
That's the word, accountability. Why is it that in our entire culture we are avoiding accountability at every turn? You attempt to complain to a regulatory body. You get in court and you go in prepared with all of your evidence, ready to present. Other side comes in and lies, and how do you defend against the lie? So the court ends up in this war of one lying about the other and the other saying that's not true, and then the court gets impatient, and then they call it high conflict. It isn't at all. And somebody, if someone is lying, that person needs to be held accountable, because that is a lot of what's destroying our judicial system, is that they entertain lying. And, you know, I'm in court all the time. I mean, they lie every day in court. And we tried to expose to a judge, and he said, what's new? You know, they're sick of it, too.
Mm-hmm. Do you think most judges are really trained in this? I know that, you know, Susan Settembrino, who we've both been on a show with, you know, previously several times, you know, she's in New York, and she feels that judges are certainly not trained for the kinds of jobs they're doing. A lot of them are political friendship kinds of appointments without really having expertise in the field. How do you feel about that when it comes to divorce court in general, from your experience?
Absolutely. They're moved around. Nobody checks to see if they know what they're doing. They're very often biased in certain ways. Some of them have had bad divorces, bad experiences themselves, and that leaks across the bench. It's very difficult, very difficult. It's judicial selection is something we need to stop in our tracks and say, have I voted for judges lately? Have I had a say in my state as to how judges are selected? Because either way, we are usually selecting them, electing them or appointing them. They're politically appointed or elected, no matter how you cut it. There's one method that is not new. It's called sortition, and it's where a bank of people serve as judges for a period of time, and they rotate. It keeps it from getting too corrupted. It keeps anyone from being on the bench for 20 years where they owe a lot of favors, and it seems to be an improved way of doing it. We worked in Nevada on that because the judges also have so much power that it's beyond what a normal human being ought to have. People should not have that much power without oversight. And what's happening, we're having to beg the Department of Justice and beg regulatory bodies to come in on court situations because it's been hands-off. Let the judges do what they want. It's their discretion. No. And now that so much of what I work with, because no matter how you cut it, when you go through these tough things, you wind up with a qualifying disability. You wind up depressed, anxious, upset somehow, PTSD, stressed out, or you develop, if you have any kind of weakness in your body, your immune system will be lowered from this stress, and that will manifest more. So when you're going to court, you are struggling with a tougher battle than your opponent in many cases. So it is very important to use the federal law that is administrative. You don't ask the judge if you can use the wheelchair ramp. same thing with the accommodations for the invisible disabilities, like depression, et cetera. And it's amazing the difference that just a little kindness and patience and taking a few breaks and being, you know, that being, I have to look, is my client breathing? You know, do they need water? Are they able to focus? Are they okay? And lots
these are
of
things
times,
that you would look at, but most people would take it for, they wouldn't care. You're sitting in a courtroom. You know, they're not there thinking about your emotional state. They're thinking about getting their job done and getting out of there. I mean, there is no compassion like you're showing. I mean, this is something that's sorely lacking in a courtroom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When we go into the courtroom, we kind of shock them because I don't put up with my client being beat up on. And I won't have it, and it's against the law. And as we progress in the case, the judge realizes that. They very often will go back and research what I'm telling them, and they come out and realize this is law now. If my client has depression, then they have to be treated with more patience and with the proper accommodations in court. If they're afraid of their opponent, they can't be in court right by that person's side. And if they're pro se, they can't be questioned by that person. Or they'll be intimidated. Sometimes it's just the aroma of the abuser walking in the courtroom and their body language. Body language triggers a different part of the brain than verbal language. So if you have someone lying about you and using intimidating body language, you're getting a double whammy. And the court doesn't realize that unless I point it out. And I say they have to appear from a sequestered room or something, you know.
Now, how is your luck, how is your luck, that's what I'm going to call it, luck, with being an advocate?
Oh, I've done it for so long that I think it's quite good, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have to do in order to succeed at it is you have to not be easily bluffed. You have to know what you're doing, and that's why I do the training I do in the webinars, because I train
people. And
I'm people.
So excited about that. You know, I really want to talk about your webinar and the training, because I think some of our women would really love to do something like this.
The
so
people,
can we start at the, let's start at the beginning about your training.
Okay. I do it online because I have people from all over the country, actually all over the world sometimes, that take the training, and we can't all gather in one place. Everybody's short of money, so I do it on a webinar. I use a slide format where it's illustrated and written, and I also online present it live at the same time. It's 18 hours of instruction, and it prepares the person to be an advocate, to go into court with a person with a disability, get their accommodations if they wish to go in and advocate in the courtroom, how you go in that courtroom, and you are then like that person's body. They cannot remove you from that person when you are that person's advocate. You are offsetting a symptom. It's just like they can't come and take a wheelchair away from somebody. So we pass the bar. We go right up and sit at the table with the person. I sit right next to them, and I keep an eye on them. And we will have prearranged the accommodations. So I know when my client isn't breathing and their eyes are glazed over, and the opposing side has been saying very hurtful things, I know it's time to take a break, and I cue the judge. We need a short break. We record very often. Now, many courts say you can't record. Nonsense. If my client has memory problems and we don't trust two things about the regular transcripts, one, they have been altered. I have 180 examples of alteration of transcripts. So we don't trust them. And also, they're not immediately available, and they're terribly expensive. My clients are being denied the histories of their cases. So we really are firm with the court that we must record. My client deserves a private audio of what happened in court, or video sometimes. And so we use pens that we get at Best Buy that are very good, and they're not obtrusive. But mm-hmm. I had an intelligent judge one day, the DA, it was a criminal situation. The DA said, I think someone's recording in here. And the judge said, everybody might be recording. You can't control that anymore. Earrings record, buttons record, keychains record, you know. My pen records. So anyway, we get those kinds of accommodations for people, and I teach you how. And then you are so protected. USC 42, 12201 to 12203 protects advocates. You cannot be intimidated, harassed, removed from your client, anything without violating federal law. So once you take the training, you get your feet solidly on the ground, and then you say, I can do this. And you don't go in, and when the other side starts saying, I think that's unlicensed practice of law, that you get scared and quit. No, not at all. You're totally protected when you're advocating. We're not being lawyers. We're being advocates. Now, that's different from being an activist, and I clarify that in the webinar, too. The webinar uh-huh. gives 18 hours of credit for lawyers or paralegals and 16 and a half for behavioral health professionals, nurses, any profession that has to relicense can
wow.
do this.
This is wonderful. And
it's six,
when is this taking place?
6 hours of ethics. It starts September 30th, this class, and it
mm-hmm.
goes every day in October. We meet at 10 o'clock Pacific time in the morning for three
mm-hmm.
hours for 6 weeks. Then you get a certificate and a badge. You get a badge so you can walk in the court and show somebody because you can't carry your certificate around. So we give you a laminated badge that you go in the courtroom, and it's being honored in several places. I had an attorney challenging it in Northern California with one of my graduates, and the judge absolutely honored it. So we have good judges around the nation are really appreciating what we do because they get people, schizophrenic people. They get people with mental illnesses, with various conditions. They don't know what to do with them. We come in. We have it all pre-prepared. We work with the medical staff. We're liaisons. I walked in not too long ago, and the judge said, I am so glad you're here. It was with an autistic client. So
this is just so amazing. So in other words, let me just understand this again. So, you know, people listening for the first time, which won't necessarily be today, it'll be throughout the week. If you have an interest in being an advocate, now, is this a job appointed by anyone? Can people hire you? Is this something you can make, you know, any kind of money from?
Well, I make a living from it.
Do, because you're a professional, but I'm saying for your average person who would be taking this.
It depends on how you do it. And is supposed to pay you. I'm working now on a program that I'm going to be attempting to get implemented where they are paid just like foreign language interpreters because it's just the same way. If you have autism or you have expressive speech problems, you have a communication problem, you have to have someone there. So, I'm trying to get paid about $65 an hour for people. It's going to take us a little while, but the law says the court has to pay you.
In other words, somebody can advertise though that they can be a court advocate and they can have their own little business with this?
I have several people in the country that are doing that. Paralegals, it's a natural for them.
Mm-hmm.
Several lawyers have taken my course, and they told me that it's changed their practice. Now,
wow.
If they sign up, I better give my website. It's equalaccessadvocates.com. Plural Advocates, EqualAccessAdvocates.com. and all the information is there, and then my email, legalabuse@gmail.com. Anybody can email me, and I'll direct them. It does.
And if you didn't get
money,
that from Dr. Huffer, you know, you can just write to me, and I'll forward you her information. And, Karen, I'll be very happy to announce this in my upcoming newsletter, because it does go out to several thousand people, like 7,000 around the country,
great,
many of whom are in human services and who would probably really enjoy doing this.
I do have to charge for it.
Right, but it's a very reasonable amount for what you're getting.
Yeah, it is. And this time, I just sent you a flyer on it. This time I'm doing an early bird. So if they sign up by August 15th, they get $100 off. So, yes, it absolutely, it pays for itself in time.
Mm-hmm.
And my clients tell me that our fees are the best money they ever spent on their whole case.
Oh, I just love
and
this. It's really wonderful. I have your flyer and the live online webinar and from 11 to 2. And that starts September 30th, and it's every Thursday in October?
Uh-huh.
For how many weeks is that?
It's 6 total. It's September 30th, and then every Thursday in October, and then we're done. Then they graduate.
And I think that's so great, because you get all, you know, you can use it for your, you know, if you have to get advanced credits for your job, and I think a lot of people in human services do need to do that. And I wonder even if they can get, do you think they can get reimbursed for places have tuition reimbursement? Maybe you can have your company pay for this.
Absolutely. Many companies have paid for it. Also, there are churches that are sometimes allowing a scholarship for someone to take it. The church will pay the fee, and the person comes, and then they are available to the members of the church, that kind of thing.
This is really exciting. I really love this. So if anybody's out there, I will be happy to send you the flyer, and I will definitely put this in our upcoming newsletter that goes out on August 1st. And I'll be reminding them it's September 1st also.
Thank you. He said that we will start a revolution. He said it's going to be a quiet revolution humanizing our court system. And truly, we are doing that. It's just way too little. We just need so many more people out there.
And once again, I just want to be clear on this. You don't have to have a background in law or in human services. You can still do this, right?
Absolutely, because the training, if you have a sensitivity for this, if you've been to court, some of my people have a street PhD in having gone to court and all of what goes on there. And those people make wonderful advocates. If you have a sensitivity toward people and you want to help people who, no fault of their own, they're autistic or have a disability and they can't make it in litigation, then you're perfect for the job.
Not only that, Karen, but also for a lot of our women who now have to go and first go back to the workforce, this may be really a great direction for them as far as, you know, many of them are helpers by nature, and this might be something part-time they could do or even full-time by getting, you know, starting off at least with a certification, because this is a case where you do, this is a course where you get certified. So you actually have a legitimate certification and doing something that you could love doing, which is really great.
Right. Some of my people have gone to domestic violence shelters, and they work a deal with them where they class for those people, but they see that they get help. It's just endless, the need for it. Law firms need you. Paralegals need you. Churches need you. Domestic violence. Old people. Oh, my gosh, what's being done with guardian abuses with old people.
So with the workshops, does each week focus on a different aspect of advocacy?
Yes. Yes, we take you through how to get the accommodations, what to expect, the law itself, the ADA, so you understand it thoroughly. So you know how to go after the local rules and laws, and then how to do the eight steps because that's the counseling coaching part that helps your client get through. Pretty soon you'll look at them and you'll know exactly which step to use. You'll say, we need a break, Your Honor. You take them out in the hallway or something, and you reframe with them, which is a three-step process for getting yourself back intact after you've been assaulted in the court with nasty words, you know. Very important. So,
are there materials that come with this, or a book that you have to buy, or?
You get a book. Everything comes with the course, with the price of the course. You get your book, you get all of the instruction, you get the certificate, you get the badge, and you get follow-up, because I don't leave any of you in the lurch. We work together from then on, and as you encounter difficulties, I try and help you solve them.
I think that is such a wonderful opportunity. I'm really going to spread this word, and I'm really excited about it, because I think so many women don't know what direction to go in. They want to be helpers. They don't want to spend years in college right now because they have to do something else. And I'm not saying to make this a full-time job, but at least you can do this part-time, get your feet wet, maybe use some of this towards some college credit, you know, for the future, or at least put your way in there into the field of human services and get some exposure to it. And, you know, you can even kind of specialize for women who are in our situations. We're always looking for advocates who can be pain pals for our women, people who can advise them. So I think this could really start something big. I'm really excited about it. I mean, everything you do is just wonderful as far as helping people who are just no longer really able to help themselves because they're under all this stress.
Going through
these traumatic situations, right?
And they lose by attrition. Our courts are not doing due process of law. They're beating people up until they lose by attrition. And that's not what the court is designed to do.
And especially, I guess, women really worry and they give in to things because they do have limited resources. A lot of them don't have any resources. And so they feel like they're losers before they even get in there.
Their self-esteem is so bashed, so beat up, and then it gets worse in the courtroom. And on top of that, court lawyers many of the time. And so they're in there by themselves trying to deal in a foreign environment with an esoteric language, and it's impossible. They have to have somebody by their side that's helping them.
I am really excited about this. I know you can't tell how excited I really am, but I really am. I just think this is going to be a wonderful opportunity for some of our women. And I will be writing it up tomorrow and really sending it out just to my preliminary list, members of my online club, and really getting the word out there. I really believe in this. I think it's wonderful you're doing this. So I'm going to just leave you again with, you know, can we announce again the website that they can go to? Or is there a Facebook page that you have this on also?
It's my name, Karen Huffer, Karen with an I. And the website is equalaccessadvocates.com. All one word, Equal Access Advocates, plural. And if you put my name in the computer, you find I'm everywhere.
Or beautiful pictures of you everywhere. And you just got back from Greece, right?
Yes. I spoke at an international conference in Greece, and I introduced legal abuse syndrome internationally for the first time. And I cannot believe the good reception we got. I'm following up. We're going to be doing work with John Jay College in New York, and we have two yearly conferences coming up that are going to be very important, one on the Olmstead Act, that protects people from disabled people from being institutionalized or taken advantage of with guardians, et cetera. And then the next will be the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we're going to be preparing materials for that.
I was just wondering, after you run this seminar in September, are you going to be running it throughout the year again?
I do two or three a year.
Okay,
it's
good.
Usually work into the my schedule, but at 2 or 3 a year, I will do.
That's great, because this way I can keep spreading the word, even if people come later on into our network, so they can know it's not just, darn, I missed it. They can do it at a later time, right?
Yes. I since I deal with attorneys taking the class and stuff that can't be at every class, I send you a video of it after we finish. So you get the video and audio of the whole thing after the class is finished.
Wow.
And
I'll tell you, when people see how inexpensive it is to get certified in something this wonderful, they're going to be amazed. So I am really going to push this. I really appreciate you doing this. And
thank
I really
you,
appreciate you coming so much on the show and sharing your knowledge and your wisdom and your compassion, your empathy, because our women really need it. And I'm really hoping that you'll come back again after you finish the seminars. Hopefully we'll have some of the women there. And yes, I'm planning on that. I'm going to be promoting this because I just think it's a wonderful opportunity. I'm really psyched about this. So I'll be sending it out tomorrow to a lot of people. I'm going to write it on my Facebook page when I hang up with you now. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, I have a special group for our women, so I'll certainly have it on there and discussing it with them tonight. But
well,
thank you so much for being part of this. And you're just an amazing woman that
and
someday
so are
I'm
you
looking forward to. Thank you. But I really want to meet you one day, so when you're in New York, hopefully you'll... You won't forget that. I want to come there and give you a big hug for everything you're doing.
Well, sometime come to the mountain in Colorado.
That probably won't be happening too fast, but, you know, I'm getting a little old to travel now, but I am going to California in October and September. And so you never know. I may have a stop over there. I'll certainly let you know.
Okay.
But I really do appreciate it so much, and I'll be looking forward to having you back on here and to getting you some great women for your seminar.
Thank you. All righty. Good night, Bonnie.
All right. Thank you, and good night to our listening audience. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.